So the title of my talk today is Seven Vinayas for the Contemporary Sangha. So Sangha is a word that most of you know. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are the three jewels, the teacher, the teachings, and the community of people who together follow the teachings. All three of these are vital. All three are important. So today I'm going to be talking about Sangha, not the worldwide Sangha or the United States Sangha or the Minnesota Sangha, but our Sangha, MZMC. And I'd like to start just by saying that I find such joy in Sangha. And I know many of you do too, even in our Zoom Sangha. And I think a lot of you, a number of you, have actually joined us after the pandemic began. So you've never been inside our building and you've never met some of us in person. And so far, our mutual existence is on Zoom. But I hope even if you're doing just that, that you can feel or at least get a hint of some of the joy of these connections. I hope you're eager to get to know other folks better. And I think we're all wondering, what's it going to be like when we get back together in person? And I think, well, we can't really know. But hopefully we will be together, many of us, back in the Zendo in maybe 60 days or so, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. I hope some of the long distance folks will be able to come see us sometimes once we reopen, maybe come for an annual retreat or just for a visit, because it's different in person. And right now, I think just about everyone agrees, it's an awkward time. It's like we're all lunging forward to get a hug, and at the same time, a little part of us is saying, wait, don't do that, that's not safe. It's a strange time. The whole reentry thing is kind of awkward. And some folks are kind of hesitant to reenter society. And I think that's just fine. I think we can all follow our own timetable. There were some nice things that happened during isolation, and maybe we want to carry those forward. Maybe we don't want to be too quick to go back to life as usual. Other people are jumping in. And it's a joyful time and a slightly scary time, and I think a bit of a confusing time. And that's fine. It'll be what it'll be when we're back together, and let's not dwell in our expectations too much. Let's embrace the joy and the awkwardness and the chaos and the hesitancy and the wonder, whatever it is that comes. So construction of our building is still on schedule. If you've just joined us, we're adding a new Zendo. We've added some accessibility features, and we're redoing the stucco and the windows in an environmentally friendly way. It's a big project, and we've shut down the center. And construction is still on schedule to be completed by the end of June, except for the storm windows and the landscaping and the parking lot. And then I think it may take us about a month to get things ready, because we need to clean and we need to set up new systems, and there is a lot of work to do. And if you're interested in volunteering to work inside the building, probably during the month of July, let me know. Send me an email or send an email to Zen Center. And we're hoping for a reopening around August 1st. Could be a little sooner, could be a little later. and I don't know how it's going to feel. It may feel kind of like a new era. I don't know. We've been closed for 15 months. Our space is going to be all different. We have a Sangha that's more national now. We will be continuing our Zoom activities as we continue our in-person programming, and this will be new. So we have a chance of carrying on our tradition as always, while making it new in many ways. So I think it's a good time to talk about Sangha and some principles for maintaining a healthy Sangha, because our group is so precious. So the title again is Seven Vinayas for the Contemporary Sangha. So first I'll give some background on the Vinayas, and then I'll talk about our Sangha. So the Vinayas are monastic rules, and they're part of the Pali Canon, as many of you know. The Pali Canon is a group of texts that were compiled after the Buddha's death, containing his teaching. So they're the original teachings of the Buddha, pre-Mahayana, pre-Zen. And the Sanskrit term for the Pali Canon is Tripitaka, which means three baskets. There's the Sutra Pitaka, or the basket of discourses, the Abhidharma Pitaka, or the basket of higher teachings, and the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the basket of discipline. And that's the one I'm going to talk about this morning. It's the basket of monastic law. And it was developed to regulate the lives of the monks and nuns, as well as their relationship with the laity in the Buddha's time. They grew to be 250 rules for monks and 500 rules for nuns. You'll notice the disparity. I think that reflects the sexism of the time. I think a lot of these rules were added after the Buddha's death. Some scholars say it may have taken 200 to 300 years for all of them to be added in. And I think what that suggests is that the Buddha maybe was fairly lenient and fairly uncomplicated, but that over time, things tended to harden as Buddhism developed and it became more of an institution. But the core of the Vinayas, as far as we know, was developed by the Buddha. And he needed these rules because there were large groups of monks and nuns following him, and they were living all together, and they had to have rules of behavior. And the story is that he didn't start out with any rules at all, but then something would go wrong, and he would make a rule for it. So he was making it up as he went along. And he was lenient and tolerant by nature, and had to deal with problems as they came up. And what I find interesting about these rules is, yes, many of them were about behavior and good morals, being moral, doing the right thing. But a big part of it also arose from a concern for harmony in the community. Karen Armstrong, in her book, Buddha, says that living in community in the Buddha's time was a real challenge because you had all of these monks and nuns who had come together separately. They didn't practice together, they had separate groups, but they had all come together from various backgrounds and they were living in really austere conditions. Think of a retreat when little things become important. And, you know, if lunch isn't quite right, you're like, oh no, that's the only thing I had to look forward to today. You know, things could get kind of heightened. So things happen. Karen Armstrong, in her words, she says they were living with people whom they might not find personally congenial. So that, she said, put their equanimity to a test. It was no good radiating compassion to the four corners of the world if they couldn't get along with each other. And sometimes the Buddha would have to take his followers to task. One time, there were some monks who didn't care for another monk who had dysentery. That's an unpleasant job. The monk said, oh, don't bother about me. Just go ahead, go to town and beg. And they were all too quick to take him up on that. And the Buddha and Ananda ended up caring for the monk personally. And they reminded the other monks that everyone in the Sangha deserved the same care that the Buddha himself would get. Another time, the Buddha's group was traveling, and some monks went ahead to the place where they were going to stay and secured all of the beds for themselves. And poor Shariputra, who had a bad cough, had to spend the night under a tree. And so the Buddha was very clear with them that simply would not do. Also, there were schisms in the Sangha. One time, a sutra master, which I assume was one of the more experienced and wise monks, forgot to clean out a wash basin, and somebody called him out on it. And he wouldn't admit fault because he was the sutra master. And this big argument happened, and other monks were drawn in, and they started choosing sides. And it got so bad that the Buddha actually left the group for a while and went to live in the forest by himself while the monks worked it all out. So they were very human, and these things could happen. So the last section of the Vinayas, at least in the version that I looked at, I think there are a number of different versions, is called Rules for Settling Disputes. And one of them was that if there was a dispute, they'd gather in a group and they would try to reach consensus as to what the proper course of action was to resolve the dispute. If they couldn't do that, they would resolve it by majority. And the rules covered both serious offenses and minor offenses. The most serious offenses called for expulsion. Expulsion of monks who have been guilty of murder, theft, or sexual offense, or who have unsuitably extolled their own sanctity. Interesting that false claims of enlightenment is right up there with murder, sexual offense, and theft. There were other offenses that called for provisional expulsion, and minor offenses that mostly called for confession before the Sangha. They would all come together and you would have to confess your minor offense. Or sometimes if you had acquired something you weren't supposed to have, you would forfeit that thing. So a lot of these rules had to do with controlling sexual urges and greed and being truthful. They were really detailed. For example, an extra alms bowl could be kept 10 days at most. Beyond that, it is to be forfeited and confessed. Another says, should any bhikkhu with an alms bowl having fewer than 5 mens ask for another bowl, it is to be forfeited and confessed. So you have to fix your bowl 5 times before you ask for a new bowl. So these are comprehensive rules, and they remind me a little bit of the rules that Dogen developed at Aheiji, sort of regulating every aspect of a monk's life. And detailed rules like that can be wonderful. They can help you let go of choice and deepen your practice. And they can seem really oppressive, particularly on a bad day when you're worn out and a little tired of all of the austerity. But there are a couple of things to keep in mind. As I said, I think a lot of these rules were probably added by overzealous Sangha leaders long after the Buddha was gone. Perhaps they were a little insecure about their ability to follow the Buddha, to be disciplined enough, so they thought they had to be really heavy-handed. Also, these rules, keep in mind, were for monks, not for laity, and it's common in most religions, I think, to be pretty strict with those who are entrusted with upholding the faith and teaching it. So here's the question. What do these rules have to do with our practice? Well, we might say not so much. They were developed 2,500 years ago. They were developed in northern India. They were developed for people who aren't so much like us. These are people who had left their families. They lived together in the forest, and they were celibate, and they had almost no possessions at all. And vinayas are for monks. Lay people don't have them. They have precepts and other sorts of vows. So in talking about vinayas for our sangha, I'm using that term vinaya pretty loosely. But one thing I think that ties us to these rules that were developed in a very different place and time for people who were a lot different from most of us, is that original spirit of harmony in the community that motivated much of what was done here, and the importance of that harmony. In the book, The Living Buddha, written by Daisaku Ikeda, he says that in his later years, Shakyamuni Buddha, while continuing to preach the Dharma, gave a lot of thought to administrative problems in running the Sangha. So the Buddha was, above all, practical. Being in the world, not escaping it, is what he was all about. And it's the same with us. We need to pay attention to our Sangha. Sangha is a joyful thing, but sometimes we need to work at it. So I'm offering a few guidelines, and these are based on my experience with the Sangha, which goes back 28 years. I don't mean to be preachy. If in talking about this, I mention ways in which people can be unskillful, please remember that it's with the knowledge that I myself have been unskillful many times, and I'm still working on these things myself. I offer these observations because I think they can help us. These are things I've learned from long experience and making mistakes myself. And I'm not trying to make strict rules here. I'm offering these more in the spirit of the precepts, which many of you know the precepts, many of you have taken them or are preparing to take them this fall, but they take into account that every situation is different and that no rule can apply in every situation. Now, sometimes monastic practice, say, can lend itself to pretty strict rules. Even our retreats, you can be pretty strict, no talking, no cell phones, that kind of thing. But our lay practice, our day-to-day Sangha practice, requires flexibility and constant reevaluation and approaching each situation and seeing all of the interconnections. The thing about strict rules that's unhelpful is that they take you off the hook in that you don't have to think too much about anything. You just follow the letter of the law. But that can lead to a kind of narrowness. So guidelines, not rules. So the first vinaya for the contemporary Sangha, which I think is the most important, and it's the one I'll spend the most time on, I'm calling it allow the community to be the teacher. We have many teachers. Our community may be our greatest teacher. This is about respecting the wisdom of the community. And I look around and I think about all of the incredible people in our Sangha. And this is about finding the middle way in community. And this is important because we're like the Buddha's followers. We come together from many different backgrounds. We have a lot in common, but there's a lot that's different too. And I've noticed in making decisions about the community, which I need to do, that often on an issue, there is a very wide range of opinion. And a difficult lesson of Sangha leadership is that sometimes, no matter what you decide, someone is going to be unhappy with the decision. Sometimes things get so complex, you have to make a decision that no one's happy with. But hopefully everyone can tolerate it, and that may be the best that you can do. And I can give some examples. I have three or four examples here. One is, do we have a lot of ritual? Some people love a traditional practice and ritual, and they want more of it. And other people are fine without it. And I think that as a community, we've reached a happy medium that's okay with everyone. We provide both kinds of programming, and people can gravitate toward what works best for them. And I think people are very good at accepting, well, this particular event, it's not exactly what I prefer, but I'm happy to be part of it and support it because I know that there are other folks as well who appreciate this, and it helps them with their practice. So another example is about our building and how we clean our building. So we don't have a residential center, and we rely on volunteers for almost everything. And sometimes maybe things get a little lax. It's been known to happen. And some folks, for whatever reason, have really high standards when it comes to cleanliness. Other folks just don't really notice it very much. And we've had people get a little upset because our standards aren't high enough. And others get a little upset because they're saying, like, why are we cleaning stuff that's already clean? We're overdoing it. And I have to say to folks on both ends of the spectrum, we all need to accept that things aren't going to be exactly as we want them to be. This isn't your house, this is our house. And of course, these kinds of divergences of opinion, which usually get resolved really quite easily and with some good humor, these have been apparent in the construction process. I remember early on, we solicited opinions about what to change and what not to change. And I remember two people mentioned the beams on the ceiling. You may have noticed in the Zendo, we have these kind of faux dark beams across the ceiling. And I remember one person said, I really love the beams. Whatever you do, keep the beams. And another person said, I've always hated the beams. Whatever you do, get rid of the beams. So that's kind of how it goes. By the way, we kept the beams. Hope that's okay. So in making these decisions about the building, we've tried really hard to involve the appropriate folks along the way and get decisions from the people who will be affected the most. And I know there's probably no one person who's going to be satisfied with all of the choices, but I'm pretty confident that everybody is going to be able to live with the result. And I think most of us are gonna love the result. We shall see. I'm pretty confident, I'll say. I've seen it happen on more than one occasion, and this makes me really sad, that someone comes to Zen Center and they really fall in love with the place. They really fall in love with the community and they become really active. And they idealize the community. And maybe they idealize it a little too much. And they develop a kind of expectation that things will always be perfect. And then something happens. It could be a little thing, it could be a big thing, but it hits them all of a sudden that they're working with real people here. with human beings who have preferences and failings. And that challenges the ideal. And that's a turning point. And they have a choice here. They can leave because it's not an ideal community. And some folks do that. And they may go on searching for that ideal community, or they may give up on community and go it alone. And I'm not saying that everyone who decides to leave is at fault somehow. If you find out that your basic values are different from the organization, or that Zen practice isn't for you, well, then it just makes sense to leave. But sometimes, well, I think it's appropriate to look inward a little bit when you come up against this edge. Some folks reach that point of choice and they decide to stay because they are realistic enough to know that there are humans everywhere, even at Zen centers. No place is exempt. Life is about working things out. That's true in our families and our jobs, as well as in our religious institutions. The sticky situation that you don't like has something to teach you. Staying in the midst of imperfection is consistent with our practice. If you've read Pema Chodron, you know that she's all about sticking with it when things get hard. And this is a little passage from When Things Fall Apart. She says, "Life is a good teacher and a good friend. Things are always in transition if we could only realize it. Nothing ever sums itself up in the way that we like to dream about. The off-center, in-between state is an ideal situation, a situation in which we don't get caught and we can open our hearts and minds beyond limit. It's a very tender, non-aggressive, open-ended state of affairs. To stay with that shakiness, to stay with a broken heart, with a rumbling stomach, with the feeling of hopelessness and wanting to get revenge, that is the path of true awakening. Sticking with that uncertainty, getting the knack of relaxing in the midst of chaos, learning not to panic, this is the spiritual path. Getting the knack of catching ourselves, of gently and compassionately catching ourselves, is the path of the warrior. Life is our teacher. Our community is the teacher. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Sangha is not a distraction from practice. Sangha is not a means to do the practice. Sangha is the practice, the very heart of it. And Zen practice, contrary to popular belief, is not about bliss. Bliss may come, but Zen practice is about showing up. Our practice involves staying with discomfort. And sooner or later, community will provide you with the opportunity to do that. Another example is the question of how much we talk about the subject of social justice at MZMC. There's a wide range of opinion on that, and there are some strong opinions. And sometimes, frankly, folks question whether they want to stay with it. They want to find another group, maybe, that is either more socially active or less socially active. They're coming up against that edge, that community edge, that personal edge. And we have a choice here of whether to stay with that shakiness, as Pema calls it, or whether to flee and find something else that matches our ideal. I say stay. We'll keep things in balance. I promise you, we will listen to each other. If we can't work it out here, where are we going to work it out? So the second of the vinyas I call, it's the doing of it that matters. It's the doing of it. And this is about our day-to-day lives at Zen Center, how we do it, how we show up, how we are in each moment, how we move and interact and pay attention to little things, how we take off our shoes, how we pull a single weed, how we put on our rakusu, how we are in setting up the chairs, how we are in meetings, how we are on Zoom. Nothing is exempt. Embodied practice, showing up, being there, being here, right now. I'm thinking of Zenju's teaching, which if you didn't catch is available on some kind of a recording. Can you take that meditating, chanting mind with you into the Dharma talk, into work practice, into the Zoom meeting? So as you know, I'm excited about reopening. I'm excited about meditating together, gathering on Sunday mornings, gathering on Tuesday evenings, hearing those great talks, but I'm equally excited about doing the work. We have an opportunity here for mindful work and skillful interaction, and it's my hope that everyone will be able to proceed mindfully and joyfully in this work, not rigidly. We can have fun, but coming back, staying awake. It's the doing of it that matters. It's the process, not the result. Peace is every step. The third vinaya is speak directly. I've talked about this before. I've talked to many individuals about this, maybe not so much in Dharma talks. So we're, many of us, mild-mannered Buddhists, and most of us are Minnesotans. And it's no secret that speaking directly is not our forte. People who come here from other places really notice this. And it's okay. And there's some really wonderful things about it. I'm kind of fond of it, and I'm used to it myself. But sometimes I think we need to nudge ourselves a little bit toward the middle on the direct speech, evasive speech continuum. One of the vinyas was no evasive speech. I was raised in a family in North Dakota where people were pretty circumspect about their own needs. It came from a place of kindness, but I think it also came from a place of fear of conflict a little bit. It was the kind of family where you might ask, so what should we do this afternoon? And instead of saying, oh, here's what I want to do, your first inclination is to try to figure out what everybody else wants to do and say that. So you don't assert your own needs. And what ends up happening is you come to kind of a weird compromise based on inaccurate information, and you end up doing something that no one really wants to do. It's like coming to a four-way stop in your car, and there are four cars there, and nobody goes. You just sit there. So what I've come to learn is that if you don't speak up in the beginning, you may proceed down this long road that's based on inaccurate information. And it gets worse and worse. And then eventually you have to confront this whole big thing and say the thing that you could have said on that first day. And when you speak directly, of course, you want to speak kindly and compassionately and you start with common ground and friendship and praise. But you do find a way to get to the heart of the matter. And in the past, I've recommended a book called Difficult Conversations, which I read and has helped me, because this is a skill I've definitely needed to acquire. And I recommend that book. So let me be clear in saying be direct. I don't mean constantly complain to everyone about everything. There are a lot of things that we can just let go. And that has to do with let the Sangha be your teacher. If it's just something where you know, well, people have different opinions, and so we're finding middle ground here, and I'm fine with just letting that go, you don't need to mention it. But sometimes things come up and you need to talk about them. And another aspect of this is to talk to the appropriate person. Usually, if you have an issue with someone, it's best to talk to that person. Talk to the person who can do something about the problem, not to everyone else. Sometimes I kind of, you know, I hear things secondhand, like one person is upset with another person, or people will talk to me about how they're upset with another person. And usually my response is, that's the person you should be talking to. If someone does something that's upsetting and everybody talks about it to each other, but they never talk to that person, things will never change. So I think speaking directly is consistent with the idea that we need to take personal responsibility and stick with difficult situations. And of course, there are extreme cases. If someone has done something really harmful, it may be too difficult for the harmed person to talk to the other person directly. There may be power dynamics involved. And if that's the case, then there are ways to address that within Zen Center. So that's only three vinyas, and I don't want this to run too long, so I'm going to do the last four more quickly. Number four, err on the side of being warm and kind and welcoming. If we must err, let's be nice. This should be an easy one. I think our Sangha is very kind. It is not stark. I think our philosophy here, if I may presume to speak for everyone, is that the practice is hard enough. We don't have to add a layer of austerity and harshness and coldness and correction and things like that. We're grown up enough to trust each other to do the practice. We don't have to add that extra layer. Number five, this is one of those Zen paradoxes. Accept the magic, accept that there is no magic. Accept magic, accept no magic. This is about the middle way. This is about accepting joy. And I mean magic, not in the sense of supernatural stuff, but the kind of magic that can occur when something totally wonderful and unexpected happens. And I think of my own experience, which I've told about before. When I first came to MZMC on Buddha's birthday in 1993, I was on the run from life. And I was having a hard time. And at that time, I could not have imagined myself giving a Dharma talk to 58 people, much less becoming guiding teachers someday. And that stuff happened. And I'm still astonished. I didn't know what vividness life had to offer. And yes, there's a strong thread in Zen life of it's just daily life. Chop wood, carry water. Don't have goals. Practice without expectations. And all of this is true. So we could say on the one hand, don't look for magic. Just do this stuff day in, day out. Just show up. Don't do the stuff. Don't expect results. But at the same time, don't close yourself off to the possibility of magic either. Allow for the possibility of deep astonishing change. Number six, listen, listen, listen. Let's not try to make assumptions about what other people in the Sangha think or believe. Be open, welcoming, and non-judgmental so that no one feels hesitant to speak up. Seven, enjoy the multiplicity of teaching voices at Zen Center. We have at Zen Center 13 priests with 13 different perspectives. Everyone I talk to says this is a good thing. They really like being able to hear different points of view. And they can choose to listen to those teachers who resonate with them. And each teacher is going to be authentic and teach from the heart. And we can respect that and allow them to do so. So those are the seven. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha founded his order and he paid attention to the problems that came up and he dealt with them skillfully. And his Sangha, and now I'm speaking about the worldwide Sangha, has lasted all that time, 2.5 millennia. And I think that's not too surprising because Sangha harmony is right there in the very principles of our practice. Just to name a few, compassion, effort, right speech, and the middle way, and showing up. So, thank you.